I'm not sure how best to phrase this, but I feel like the entirety of this of the presentation kind of begs the question of is a kind of mass extinction just another kind of macro pulse? That is there is because the thing that always leaps out for me in that really wonderful poem is that really funny line about good people suddenly right towards the end. And I'm wondering about maybe the goodness of I'm fascinated by the sense of recursion, taking the sense of human exceptionalism as a good thing, and recursively applying it and reading negativity in that sense. I'm sort of broadly asking about the moralizing of vitalism, I suppose, in that sense.
Do you want to? I think it's a very good question. Do you want to answer it?
Well, I don't know if I can actually answer it, but I'll simply speak to it. Yeah. So what's your name?
Eddie.
Look, this is something I keep wrestling with a lot, and so does Tom, and we talk about it. It's one of the questions we get asked a lot, not anywhere near as elegantly as you put it, but happened extinctions always happen, so what does it matter if another one is happening? And it's a legitimate question, and I've my thinking at the moment is to actually turn it around and say it's not ours to say whether this is a pulse of some wider thing that we don't understand. What it is ours to say is that we're doing it, and we're doing it by causing untold misery, and in fact the world isn't ours to trash. Okay, it wasn't put here for us to trash. These are not lives, processes, relationships. The whole Cenozoic achievement, the whole angiosperm achievement, is not ours to just trash. So I think just putting the responsibility back onto what humans are doing, without necessarily having to link that to whether extinction, and we know the Earth will recover. So in that sense, you can say, well, what does it matter? But by that sense, you'd say, what does anything matter? You know, I think that becomes very self-defeating. I'm glad it's good to know that it will, but but it doesn't really let us off the hook, I don't think.
Yeah. And I suppose, in picking up on that, I mean, I would sort of, in a way, have sort of two different ways that I would try to respond to it. And one is that, and I do go back to this question of the 1980s, it seems to me that there was a moment there where, in some amorphous way, a sort of an extraordinary level of philosophical and political secessionism went on, particularly in the sort of society that you and I are living in, where people simply abrogated responsibility for their connectedness with the world around them. I mean, the most obvious examples, obviously, was the complete failure to deal with the resources crisis. I mean, there was an obvious capacity to do so at the end of the 1970s. There was a complete failure to do so. And we are living the crisis of that day by day by day, in the current period. And I think across the board, I think that was what was going on. If you look at so many different aspects of so-called development, commodification, the finance market, you look at everything piling up into this massive destructiveness directed mainly, obviously at other human beings in certain cases, but mainly at the natural environment. And I just think it's kind of, when you study the history of the period, I think it's pretty obvious what was going on. So I think I would have a kind of, I couldn't probably fill in all the dots, as it were, but I'd have a kind of sort of socio-political response almost to do with the cultivation of the secessionist notion and the sort of, that view that, somehow this does not matter. We can live in our sort of capsuled world. We may actually sort of go and live somewhere else on some other planet, which I think is all total fantasy. In actual fact, what we're doing is we are destroying ourselves, in my own view. And the second thing I'd say is I'd come back to what I was trying to say in the conversation, in a sense, which is that what I don't want to kind of, push the Heidegger stuff, I do think that this issue is to do with us not understanding, with at a very, very basic level, that we do not understand the way, most of us do not understand the way, that we are biologically, we are species as biologically niched in the world as the flying fox or the tree and so on. And that until we can actually accept this issue to do with living in a closed system world rather than an open system world, and here I would probably sort of in a way be slightly, you know, not at odds, but slant-wise to some sort of people, some more ecologically oriented people who in a sense want to, you know, in a sense they are good people who want to be open and, you know, to be sort of, you know, fluent in the natural world. In a sense, I almost want to go the other way and say, no, I think that I am sort of, you know, I am living in this very narrow perceptual band. And I think we've got to kind of accept this, that we're not actually familiar with all the territories of the world. We are not the possessors of the only experience. I mean, this divide that you so elegantly talked about, that, you know, the 18th century rationalist view, that I was going to add to your list amidst Boswell's man is the only animal that can cook, which he meant as a witticism, but it's kind of true. You know,
some can.
Well, indeed, I mean, yeah, exactly. But, point taken.
But Martin's a wonderful cook.
No, but no,
cooks, I think.
Very good joke.
Historically,
okay. But I think it was Long or something of that kind. Okay, I think that, you know, that in a sense there's a danger that that discourse continues into a very sort of fluent, open-minded, very sort of accepting, in a certain sense, sort of, you know, 1970s, 1980s, back to nature thing. I almost want to say the opposite. I want to say, in a sense, let's not go that way. Let's try to understand what I think Heidegger was, and others, and not just Heidegger, was trying to say back in the 1950s, and the early, late 40s, late 1950s, that the problem is that we are getting to the stage where we can now go nowhere and not see ourselves. And that is disaster, in my view, because that is a kind of presupposition that somehow your field of knowledge constitutes, you know, the fields of knowledges and so on in the world.
And maybe connecting slightly with that, the white-tailed deer poem, one of the things I find really fascinating about it is this sense of what's sort of just on the boundaries of consciousness, just on the boundaries of the mind. And that sort of resolved itself in a way at the end, but the poem sort of exploring that territory of what's sort of just within sight or that's out of sight.
Yeah, and the other thing which really, I mean, for those who don't know the area, most of you probably do, but the other thing which is, to me, if I read that poem, is kind of implicit in it, but I'm not saying it has to be, is the degree to which, I mean, you would know this territory, I mean, the degree to which the area I'm actually in, or, you know, we're talking about there, is actually an area of regrowth forest. I mean, this is an area that was, in the 19th century, was mostly farms, and has now gone back, as it were, or gone on, into being this extraordinary forest full of these extraordinary deer and other animals. And that also, I think, to me, was kind of part of my sense of that poem, that this landscape was not stable. I was not looking at wilderness. Mm. You know, I was looking at a sort of, at what had, in deindustrialization of places like, well, a lot of Massachusetts and New York State, you know, in the sort of earlier part of the middle of the last century, in a certain sense, what it actually results in, that it's not wilderness, it's actually farmland that has been abandoned at various stages, or sometimes resumed, but mostly just abandoned because of economic pressure and so on. And that little detail kind of interested me a great deal, even though it's not, in a certain sense, in the poem.